it is Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This has been a wild week. On follow-up recording day, we were already down one Janet, and just before recording time, Zach had a family situation that he had to deal with. We ended up having to cancel the follow-up recording at the last minute. So, that left me with nothing for you guys to listen to on your Friday commute. So, this is what I came up with. Since March is Women's History Month, I thought it would be cool to highlight a couple more amazing female justice warriors today. The episode you're about to hear was a true crime binge episode with one of the hosts of the Women in Crime podcast, the amazing Dr. Amy Schlossberg. Then, later this afternoon, I'm releasing another episode. That one is going to feature Dr. Schlossberg's co-host, Dr. Sachs. And that's not all. Since these episodes are over 5 years old, the docs are going to be returning together in the next couple weeks to tell us what they've been up to lately. In the meantime, sorry about the missing follow-up this week. Hopefully you'll accept this doubleheader Friday as my sincere apology. And make sure you tune in on Sunday to hear all about the incredible work being done at the Innocence Clinic at Notre Dame Law School. And without any further ado, here's Dr. Amy Schlossberg.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
So I don't do this that often.
Okay.
Well, this is my studio. My fancy studio. Always, right? So I don't do it that often. Usually I'll go to Megan's to record because she has the proper studio.
Uh-huh.
So I'm always excited when it actually, the setup works.
Yeah. It looks great. And I like the organization of your closet behind you. It looks like everything's in proper order.
That's Alan's side. If I turned the camera, you would be horrified. My husband's anal and I'm a mess.
So you just
That's
point the camera.
That's why I'm facing this way.
So I want to get, first of all, your last name is pronounced Schlossberg. Am I saying that right?
I don't know. Actually, my friends tell me I pronounce it wrong. So I say Schlossberg because I think it rolls off the tongue easier. But I'm told that it's Schlossberg.
So, and do you take your friend's input on how to pronounce your name?
I don't. I just do whatever. I'm lazy. So Schlossberg, like putting an SH on that second S, it just Schlossberg. It's fast. Saying
like
Schlossberg. Schlossberg. You know, it's like a delay if you do it the right way. So
Schlossberg. I'll go with Schlossberg if that's your preference. What do your parents, how do they pronounce it?
I think Schlossberg.
Yeah.
To tell you the truth, Bob, I don't think I've ever really heard them say their last name.
That your parents don't introduce themselves to you and speak to you as Mr. and Mrs. Schlossberg?
No.
Just been mom and dad.
Luckily, yeah, exactly. And luckily, my kids have my husband's last name, so they don't have to worry about it.
They don't have to deal with it at all.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, it's great to meet you in person. I met your partner in crime, so to speak, a couple weeks ago. I had Megan on to talk about the Direct Appeals podcast. Direct Appeals or Direct Appeal?
Direct Appeal.
Direct Appeal podcast. Maybe you guys could take some input from me. To me, it looks like it's pronounced Direct Appeals the way I see it.
Interesting. I guess it could be. Now that we're in season two, there is more than one appeal. So,
You guys, I feel like you guys are too easily influenced in the pronunciation of your name in your podcast.
We are. It's whatever the people tell us, we go with.
Right. So I just checked out a couple episodes of Women in Crime, and I'm really interested in it. This episode is going to, so for the listeners, we're in kind of a time machine here because we're recording this a few weeks ago, but this is going to drop on St. Paddy's Day, which will be just, so we are right now, what, 6 days away from you dropping an episode on a case that I covered for a year on Truth and Justice. The murder of Jim Melgar and the what I believe is a wrongful conviction of Sandy Melgar That's going to drop for you guys. You said next week on the 23rd, right? Tuesday?
That's correct. Yes. And yeah, Bob, can I just say that your podcast, I've always known about that case because I study wrongful convictions, but I fell in love with that coverage because I always knew she was wrongfully convicted, but I did not know the extent of that evidence. And I am in my car about 12 hours a week. And mm-hmm. I devoured that season on Sandy Melgar in about a week. And what is it, like 40-something episodes?
Oh, I think, yeah, probably at least that.
Yeah, and I was just, and then I was hooked from that point forward. But your coverage was incredible on that case.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Did you, I don't know how many spoilers you want to give away for next week. Did you, did you and Meg come to any kind of conclusion? I mean, I see you say that you've studied wrongful convictions, so you studied that case.
Yeah, I don't think anyone could come to any more of a conclusion than you did in that case. That was such a deep dive. But yeah, we talk about things a little bit, maybe a little bit more from like a criminological standpoint, but no, nothing really big. I was really hoping she'd be exonerated by now. And I was hoping that's what that, I was waiting to cover that case because I was hoping that she'd be exonerated. So I was like, oh, I'll cover it once she gets exonerated. But then I said, you know what? I can't sit on this story anymore. Every podcast needs to do that story.
Yeah, I agree. And I know it's so frustrating, and hopefully it's coming soon. I mean, she's got one of the best attorneys in the world working with her, Kathleen Zellner now, who coincidentally, you guys in Women in Crime did an episode on Kathleen Zellner.
Yeah.
So I think it's coming soon, but it's just, but man, the wheels of justice turn slow as it is. The wheels of justice in Texas seem to turn painfully slow. So it just seems like this is such a, you know, it's just dragging and taking so long and should be out by now. But really, I think her case is probably moving faster than most in Texas because of Kathleen Zellner's involvement.
Yeah, that was once I heard Kathleen was on the case, I said, okay, I think there'll finally be something moving here. I hope. If Kathleen can't do it, who can, right?
Yep. If anybody can get something done, they can definitely. It'll definitely be her. So I'm curious. You and Meg have two podcasts that seem to launch like almost. Pretty close to the same time. How did that happen? Did you guys come together, have coffee one day, and you both had an idea for a podcast, and you couldn't decide which one? Was there always a plan to do two? How did you guys end up with two podcasts?
So there was never a plan to do one, and definitely not two. But the first one kind of the story came to us, and then we were trying to figure out an outlet to tell the story. So that's mm-hmm. how Direct Appeal came to be.
Right.
Women in Crime. I think so. Megan teaches women in crime. And if I remember correctly, she was looking at podcasts one day and said, how is there not a podcast called Women in Crime? So they quickly, you know, similar to I heard you talk about how you have all these domains that you grab for business ideas that never were. So we're kind of similar. The second we see that a podcast has not been taken, we're like, OK, we got it, you know. So.
Right.
So we did that. We got the domain. We got the podcast name. And then we decided, you know, let's do an episodic because it serialized Direct Appeal. But we figured why not try, you know, let's dip our toe in the episodic world of true crime podcasts. And that's how that came to be.
That's awesome. So what does your guys' production schedule look like? So I also produce two podcasts, mm-hmm. Three a week, counting the follow up with Truth and Justice. But I have a team of people that do it with me. And that's all we do. We don't, you know, I don't also, you know, teach at a college at the same time. So what does a week look like for you guys? What's your production schedule? How do you make two podcasts and teach courses and have a family all at the same time?
I'm pretty shitty at it. I don't know. I'm a really shitty mom, I guess. I don't know. No, you'll edit things to make me sound like poised, right?
Right. Anyway. But shitty mom's staying in for sure.
Hey, it's got it. Someone's got to say it. We have our producer, James, who does everything. He is incredible. So I think if it wasn't for him, none of this would happen. But Direct Appeal was once we finished production on that, that's when we started Women in Crime. So that project was done. The issue now is we're doing Direct Appeal season 2 and 3 while also doing Women in Crime and also teaching and you know, I have another side job. So it's all this stuff. But we try to, I'll go to Megan's, you know, after we get our COVID test, you know, we make sure we're very, very safe. But I'll go to Megan's about once a month and we'll bang out a couple of episodes. And so right now, our episodes are, let's see, we're recorded up until like the end of April at this point. So we just keep, you know, we have a backlog so that we can kind of get ahead of things as we're starting production in Direct Appeal Season 2. Women and Crime is somewhat taken care of, at least from the recording standpoint. James is always editing, but,
right.
Megan and, we probably write only 2 episodes a month because we're biweekly and we switch off. So really, it's not that much because each of us is only releasing 1 episode a month.
You guys do a great job and your editor does a fantastic job. It's funny with you guys balancing all that. Your process is so similar to ours when we decided to add True Crime Binge to NBI Studios here. That's Mike is your James.
It's my James,
you said is your editor. Yeah. Because I have 10 of these episodes recorded at once before I started season 10 of Truth and Justice. And so I get to sit back and breathe. Of course, Mike is always every day editing, getting them all ready.
Yep, exactly. So I have the easy, I think our job's the easy part.
yeah, it is for sure, compared to the editing work. So tell us a little bit about yourself. First of all, your main job is I know you teach. What do you teach? Where do you teach?
So I teach, I'm a criminology professor and department chair at Fairleigh Dickinson University. It's a small liberal arts college in New Jersey. This semester, I'm teaching research methods, which is like a statistics class, which is nice. It's nice to kind of get a break from, I usually teach theory of crime, so I'm taking a break from that this semester. I'm also teaching wrongful convictions this semester. Last semester, I taught race and crime. I teach reentry and reintegration. I also teach in various correctional facilities around the state. So I'm currently doing that as well. Because of COVID, I haven't been in the prison in about a year, but I'm doing everything by mail, which is quite interesting.
Well, that's cool. So you were just 100% engrossed in the work that you talk about also on the podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you get into the criminal justice field? I mean, you are more into this field than anyone I think I've ever spoken to. As far as literally every element of your professional life revolves around, the study of crime and criminology.
Yeah. And I also commit crimes myself I'm just kidding.
Right. Which is answers the question as to why you're so interested in it, because that's the way to make sure you don't get caught.
Exactly. Now, from an early age, I was always very aware of social injustice, inequality. I've always wanted to do something to kind of make the world a better place, a bleeding heart from a young age. And then my work with the Innocence Project probably started my obsession with wrongful convictions. And then it just went from there. I was in forensic psychology for a little while. I was very interested in actually doing therapy in prison with death row inmates. Then I realized New Jersey doesn't have a death row, and I lived in New Jersey, so I kind of pivoted a little,
right.
And I ended up going to academia after finishing my PhD.
And so, what is your PhD in?
Sorry, my PhD is in criminal justice.
In criminal justice, what'd you write your thesis on? Thesis—that's the right word, right?
It's called a dissertation.
Dissertation—that's what I meant.
Yes, dissertating is actually a verb. Isn't that interesting? So
really?
I used to be, you might want to edit this out because it sounds so ridiculous, but Alan would call me from work. He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, I'm just dissertating on the couch. He's like, what the fuck? Because people would actually say dissertating and I'm like, that just sounds so wrong.
I don't believe that I have ever dissertated in my entire life.
You know what, Bob? You're still young. There's time.
I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pre-game podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
No, so I wrote my dissertation on, what did I write it on? Post-exoneration offending.
Okay.
I was interested in, I studied people who were wrongfully convicted and those who ended up back in prison after they were already found innocent of an original crime.
Oh, wow.
So, very fascinating. I mean, we're talking about, I think the numbers were like 30, between 34-35% of people in my sample who were wrongfully convicted ended up back in prison within 5 years.
Wow, that's fascinating. So these are people that truly were wrongfully convicted, that went to prison, had not committed the crime they were convicted for, got out and then committed a crime and went back.
Yeah, and I'm sure you have some hypotheses as to why that might be. Any idea why these individuals end up back in the system?
Well, as I dissertate over that for a second. I would think there's probably a number of reasons. One, I think, would be that our prison systems are awful. And if someone, I think that would be the biggest reason, if someone goes into our prison system, not a criminal, by the time they come out, especially when it comes to violence and a certain way of life that they've been subjected to for all those years, you know, as I always said, people don't come out of prison typically better than they went in.
Yeah, that would be, you are correct there. It's called prisonization. So it's the idea that, you know, we take an otherwise law-abiding citizen, because I did filter it out by people with prior convictions, just because I wanted to make a stronger point. And if someone has prior convictions, then we know statistically they're more likely to have future convictions.
Right.
So I did isolate those cases. I wanted to look at people who were otherwise law-abiding citizens, in air quotes, right? Because who knows what a law-abiding citizen means.
Right.
But, you know, for your research, you need to operationalize these things. So I was looking at people that had no priors. So, you know, in essence, the prison system made them a criminal.
That's fascinating. Because that was going to be the other element that I was going to add was, well, the only other thing I could think of is the wrongful conviction came from the kind of the usual suspect syndrome, where they are often committing crimes and they just happen to not commit the one that they were wrongfully convicted of. But you weeded those people out.
Well, I looked at them for other analyses. So about 40, again, this was 10 years ago at this point, but somewhere in the 40%, low 40%, those were the people that had priors.
Mm-hmm.
And you're absolutely right. It's like, you know, the usual suspect, wrong place, wrong time, or I did this, but that doesn't mean I did that. Yes, I was dealing drugs, but I didn't kill anyone.
Right.
Or, you know, those types of cases. And then I know this isn't what this conversation's about, but sorry, you got me going. Really quickly, there's also labeling theory that could explain it. People that serve time, you know, people who are wrongfully convicted do not get their records expunged. So you have, you know, these individuals having trouble getting housing, jobs.
Right.
They're not getting medical services, mental health services. I mean, the list goes on and on. And not surprisingly, people who did not receive compensation were more likely to end up incarcerated.
Yeah, absolutely, because they come out and they've got some felony on their record and they can't, you know, they can't find a job, and so they just turn to other avenues. That's fascinating work. Yeah. By any chance, did that work include, or did you look at all into the Stephen Avery case? I have my opinions on that case, but on Netflix, at least, his case kind of fits this mold, right? Where he was convicted of this rape, turns out he was wrongfully convicted. And then, I guess not on Netflix, because on Netflix, he definitely didn't then turn around and rape and kill after that.
Yeah, so when that came out, that was after I'd already, you know, published my study's findings. I can't really say if he was part of my original sample because of, you know, all these research ethical constraints that you're not allowed to talk about your research subjects. Okay. So I can't say whether or not he was included in my initial sample, but I can say that when that case became mainstream media, I found it just so fascinating hearing the narratives around it as someone who looked at that exact phenomenon,
right,
if you want to call it that. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's an interesting, you know, and I don't know if it was guilty of the murder or not. I have my opinions on it, but either way, it's still interesting the fact that, you know, he served all that time for a rape that he didn't commit, and then either lightning struck twice and he was then framed and wrongfully convicted for another crime, or he came out of prison after being wrongfully convicted and then committed a violent crime afterward.
Either way, it's a sad story,
mm-hmm.
Right? Also, you know, in that case, you can't ignore the corruption, you know, the conspiracy theories. Yeah, it's just that case is, the layers in that case are just, it's a fascinating case.
Well, speaking of layers and conspiracy theories, I guess that's a great time to transition into the case that we're gonna be talking about today. It's actually a perfect segue. This case, and so I listened, this is, for those of you that want to listen to the Women in Crime episode on this, it's episode number 8 of season 1. But I wanted to, yeah, I researched the case a little bit, and I wanted to hear your guys' take on it. And I remember when this happened. I was young, in my 20s. I remember hearing about it. Didn't really know the details until I listened to your episode and then started doing a little more research. And it is infuriating, like the most frustrating, infuriating. This is one of my top 10 cases. So we're going to be talking about the death of Lavina Johnson, who was deployed in Iraq in the army in 2005. Now, I'll let you describe kind of the basics of the case.
Okay. And I have to correct one thing, Bob. You said the death. I'm going to go and say the murder of Lavina Johnson, because
I'm glad you did, because I checked
case,
myself, because
yes.
I was going to say that in the nicest.
Well, because legally, it is the death of, right?
Right, right.
When you look at, so you actually said it the correct way, but it's so infuriating, this case, that it's, I mean, we'll talk about our theories. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to jump too far ahead. So for now, you want me to just give you a little bit of the background of the case?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. So Lavina Johnson, she lived outside of St. Louis, Missouri. And she was deployed because she wanted to help pay for her own college education. So in summer of 2005, she went to do a service tour in Iraq. Now, she was extremely close with her family. She kept in very close touch with them. And just 8 weeks into her deployment, the family receives a visit to inform them that their daughter was dead. And at this point, they're not given any information and they're shocked. They had just spoken to Lavina a few days earlier. They knew she was not in active duty. She was working at a communication center. And the father, and Lavina's father, said that the soldiers that came to the home said something about a self-inflicted wound. And then he inquired and they kind of stopped and said, oh, we don't know what happened. So from the beginning, it seemed like things were a little shady. They did not tell the family initially how their daughter died. To me, that's a huge issue. So of course, you know, the Johnson family, they were in shock. The information was so vague and so contradictory. Sorry, I'm trying not to like give away certain things, but basically, long story short, so it's a very long story. She was flown home so she could be buried with military honors. Her family had wanted to do an open casket, and they were strongly advised. They had a military liaison who was working with them, and they were strongly advised that due to her condition, they should not have an open casket. And the family said, well, she's our daughter and we're having an open casket. So they have an open casket, and she actually looks better than the family anticipated. And just to, you know, I didn't mention it before, but it turns out that Lavina died from a gunshot wound. The gunshot wound in which the military claimed was self-inflicted. Mm-hmm. They claim that she used her M16 rifle to shoot herself in her head. Then they changed her story and said that she shot herself in her chin. The family noticed all they saw was a small bullet hole on the upper left side of her head. There was not much damage to her face. And we're talking about, you know, the military said there was an M16 involved. So it didn't make sense. The bullet hole was more consistent with like a 9mm.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention, Lavina is right-handed. It was on her left-hand side. They eventually changed their, you know, they had to change their story. And they said, oh, that's actually an that must have been the exit point of the bullet. That's why it was, you know, it didn't do so much damage. Her nose looked like it was reconstructed. You can see pictures online of what she looked like before and, you know, at her open casket. She also had gloves that were glued onto her hands. And, you know, the funeral home said they had never seen anything like this. Why would anyone glue? It's almost like, what are they hiding? Why are they gluing this woman's, you know, gluing her gloves on her hands? So, again, they say
it's important to point out as far as with the gloves. That she was shipped back home in full uniform. And that's why the military liaison was there. And as part of the uniform, they put her gloves on and they literally glued her gloves onto her hand so that they couldn't be taken off.
You're absolutely correct. And yes, it is normal for them to put the gloves on the hand as part of the uniform, mm-hmm. but to have it glued where they couldn't even get it off. You know, eventually they do get the gloves off later on when they exhume the body and they, you know, they find severe burns and other, again, Bob, I'm sorry, I'm jumping around. This case just gets me.
No,
like,
it's fine. Go ahead.
All right. So according to the military records, okay, so she never shows up for her physical training. She had work that day, and then she was supposed to go to physical training. After work, she was apparently with this man. He was never identified. They went to a store to pick up, you know, M&Ms and some drinks, and then she hung out with this guy for apparently just a platonic friend. He walked her back to her tent. And then in the early morning hours of July 19th, around 1 a.m. is when her body was discovered. Okay, so the problem is everything's classified.
Right.
We don't really know. We don't know who this guy is that she was with. We don't know any of this information. But when she was found, I just want to paint the picture. Have you seen the crime scene photos?
I have. I have it on my desktop right now.
So her right hand is draped over her face. There's a large pool of blood under her head. Next to her body, there was a pile of burned papers, an aerosol can, and then there was a cot. And next to the cot was an M16 laying parallel. Okay, so how do you shoot yourself?
As I'm looking at the photo as you're describing, because I heard you guys describe it on the podcast, and I had to go look at it. It's ridiculous. I mean, absolutely insane that the Army investigators say that this was a self-inflicted wound from this M16. So, I mean, so there's three things laying parallel. You have her, and then 2 feet or 3 feet to her left is a cot laying in the same direction, parallel to her. And then 2 feet on the other side of that is the M16 laying. So there are three lines there. It's sitting, I'm guessing that's a 36-inch cot. I'm trying to scale it myself right now. The rifle is sitting 4 to 5 feet away from her hand on the other side of a cot.
Yeah. So they're suggesting what she shot herself. Not to mention, if you look at how tall she is, it's virtually impossible. She would have had to pull the trigger with her toe, but yet she had her boots on. Like it's right. Not physically possible that she could have maneuvered this weapon in the way that they say she did.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Thank you.
She's 5 foot one. And that was the first thing I thought with the first story they gave, which is that she shot herself in the side of the head. I thought there's no way a 5 foot one person can hold an M16. For to those of you who don't know what an M16 is, it's like from any of us that are my age or older, around 40s, we just called it a machine gun back in the day that you would see used in like Vietnam. And the, you know, there's different versions of assault rifles or whatever you have now, but that's what an M16 is. So it's a long rifle. And I wonder too if it was a modified version of one with a shorter barrel, but I'm looking at the photo and it's not. I mean, that thing's got to have a 26-inch barrel on it. I mean, it's a long gun.
Yeah, it's unbelievable that I think, you know, so they had to change their story because it didn't add up. And I mentioned the shot was on her left side. She's right-handed, besides the fact that the gun, the length, none of that made sense. So they say that she, you know, shot herself in the mouth. But if you look at her face is pretty much intact in this picture. Bob, wouldn't you expect to see a lot more damage to her face if she had, in fact, shot herself in the mouth with an M16?
Yeah, so very much. A couple things that I caught on the podcast, the father had said that the hole looked too small to be an M16, that it was a 9mm. So an M16 round is actually smaller in diameter than a 9mm round. It's like it's between 5 and 6 millimeters is how the diameter of an M16 round. So it's smaller. The fact that there would be a small wound like that as an exit wound, I think isn't entirely out of the question. But the reason that I know that it's bullshit is because they're saying that she had the M16 in her mouth and she pulled the trigger. And in contrary to most people, and I just know this from my former job dealing with several gunshot wounds, self-inflicted gunshot wounds over the years, that most people would think that an entry wound in a self-inflicted injury would be the small hole and then a big hole on the other side would be the exit wound. But in fact, it's usually the opposite if it's self-inflicted because you have the blowback. If someone presses a gun against their, you know, their skull, the roof of their mouth, whatever it is, the exploding gases coming out will just blow that to pieces. And then the projectile itself doesn't, you know, like if an M16 round wouldn't have time to fully open and mushroom out. And that's so you would expect a smaller exit. Not to say that's what happened here, but so what I was looking for was, is her mouth and face completely destroyed? And it's not. And so an I've never dealt with a self-inflicted gunshot wound from a high-powered rifle. It's always been with a pistol. A high-powered rifle has a massive charge. An M16 has a massive charge. And if that barrel was in her mouth, and I hate to be graphic in this, but she pulled the trigger, I mean, it would have blown her jaws off, her eye sockets, everything would have blown on the inside. And that just didn't happen. I think she was shot from a distance, you know, from a couple feet away in the head is what it looks like to me.
I think you're right. And this would have been so easy if they had only, they could have swapped the gun. They didn't swab her for, or when I say they didn't, it means it's not to anyone's knowledge because who knows what's in their reports. But was there any gunshot residue found on Lavina's hands? The bullet was never recovered. If she did, in fact, shoot herself in the mouth, wouldn't we expect that there to be her DNA on the barrel of the gun? Like, these are all questions that can easily be answered if somebody would just let someone in to these classified documents. I mean, this doesn't even scratch the surface because what really happens, you know, once they, once Lavina's father gets the CD with all the with the autopsy and the crime scene photos, this is when things really come to light because he sees that his daughter's face was badly bruised. Remember, he saw her after the military had flown her back. They gave her plastic surgery on her nose.
Right.
You know, they cleaned her up. She had bruises and scratches all over her body. There were even teeth marks on her body. She was very badly beaten. There was a trail of blood outside the tent and, you know, suggesting that Lavina had actually been dragged into the tent. There was also dirt marks on her back. And then, okay, so there is some graphic information. They found that she had burns from a corrosive chemical on her genitals. And this is possibly, I mean, also a part of her tongue was missing, a part of her vagina was missing, and a part of her anus was missing. This was, someone had used a caustic substance, I think it's called lye, that you put on a wound stat maybe. And it looks as if possibly the bullet was somewhere and someone, you know, put that substance and then maybe cut out because they didn't want DNA evidence or the ballistic evidence. I don't know. It's hard to say. There's no shortage of theories here, but what we know is Lavina did not do this to herself. And for anyone to even suggest, and then she was fully dressed when she was found.
Right.
So they're suggesting that she actually, you know, burned her genitals, bit herself, beat herself up, put her clothes back on, set fire. She had burn marks on her body. This is just simply, you know, just well, simply.
And they
possible.
Said there was literally, they removed part of her vagina and anus were removed, like cut out, and then a caustic chemical poured on them, which was just, and it is the same conclusion that you and Meg both came to on the podcast, just screamed like, obviously someone's, they think they're trying to hide biological evidence. You know, this was clearly sexual assault, and they didn't even do a rape kit.
So I read somewhere that they didn't do a rape kit because she was found fully clothed. And that is absolutely ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
That's ludicrous. I've never heard of such a thing. This clearly was one, to me, this is one of the biggest military cover-ups. And we, you know, there's a lot of them out there. But mm-hmm. this one, I think, really takes the cake as one of the worst ones I've seen.
All it takes is a quick glance at the crime scene to realize this is absolutely not a self-inflicted gunshot wound in no way, shape, or form. And then you look, it doesn't take but looking a little bit closer just at one photo. You have what, an aerosol can with stuff burnt all around that, like they were trying to burn something, burn evidence, not to mention the fact that the gun's nowhere near her. Her clothes look, nothing looks right in this crime scene photo at all.
And the military was very quick to create this false narrative around Lavina's mental health, which I think is bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
They claim that she was upset because a boyfriend broke up with her. This is a guy she had only been seeing, I believe, a couple of weeks.
Right.
They claim that she took these emails with her to the tent, burnt the emails, and then did all this. Not to mention, you're going to tell me this woman is suicidal and you're going to trust her with a service weapon? Like, come on.
This... Right, because they claim they knew this. They claim they knew she
exactly.
was suicidal.
Well, because, you know, this to me goes into some theories as to what could have happened, but she had filed, well, she didn't file a report, an actual complaint, but she was seeking medical help for a sexually transmitted disease that she got after a sexual assault.
Right. But so, she had reported as a sexual assault, if memory serves.
Correct. And of course, who knows? And of course, we can never know if that was in fact the sexual assault and, you know, who perpetrated it, but it just, you know, they're trying to make all these claims that just have absolutely no basis. She was eating a lot of ice cream, they said. So she was depressed. Like, it was just, it's offensive to, I think it's offensive to women. And it just shows the way women, when women are victims, how they're just torn apart. And it's so quick to assume that a woman's so fragile that if a boyfriend breaks up with her, she's going to go and kill herself. I mean, it's just insulting.
In the fact, it's so insulting to think that the United States military, at least the, you know, the commanders of this post and base, think that the rest of the world and her family is so stupid that you know, that, as you said, well, women are fragile, they're this and that. They could look at this scene and once, thank God, her father pushed and pushed until he got the autopsy reports and all the evidence in the case, at least some of the evidence in the case, that they could give that to him and be like, well, yeah, but she was just a woman and she was depressed. So pay no attention to what your eyes are telling you. Just ignore all that. Just listen to what we're telling you.
So insulting. I feel so very horrible for the Johnson family. I could not even imagine. Could not even imagine.
It's all, and some of the, and I guess I'll let you get into it too, but I mean, some of the other evidence that caught me, you know, the glued gloves, when they removed the gloves, they found, what was it, second or third degree burns on her hands that they were trying to hide?
I read both. Yep. It looked like second or third degree burns, which I guess would go along with, you know, I think it goes along with the theory that someone's trying to cover up the evidence, mm-hmm. right? DNA under the fingernails. Well, let's burn that away, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and you can't stress enough, as we talked about a second ago, but just to make very clear, someone beat the hell out of her. I mean, she had fractures to her face and bruises and scratches all over her body. As you said, bite marks, the mutilation to her genitalia and all that. I mean,
I believe her neck was, I'm sorry, I don't know if I mentioned, but I believe her neck was fractured as well.
Yeah. And that information, I think you guys said, came from, they eventually exhumed her body and did their own autopsy.
they have spent thousands of dollars on exhuming the body and doing more autopsies, having experts, and these news stations. I don't want to throw any news stations under the bus. I don't need to name names. I might have in the other episode, but a lot of big news outlets put a lot of money into this case and then didn't even end up running the story.
Right. I'll throw them under the bus. CBS
you
paid
go.
for the exhumation of the body. And then paid for an independent autopsy. And then the autopsy reports come back and confirm all of these other. I mean, 100% she was murdered, including they find that her neck was broken. And then CBS wouldn't run the story. ABC also did a bunch of work on it, wouldn't run the story. And I have to imagine that that had to do with you guys mentioned advertising dollars on the podcast, but even access, for a major news network to have access, because. Let's not forget, I mean, the military, the commander in chief of the military lives in the White House. And so, there could be an issue, which is even more frustrating when you go all the way up. This was 2005. So we're talking about the second Bush is the commander in chief at the time. And frankly, every U.S. president, because this is not a unique situation to Lavina Johnson. It's a very obvious incident. But women being abused and it being covered up in the military has been going on for decades through multiple different commanders in chief, and no one's ever done a damn thing about it.
No, never. And it just keeps happening. And there is a little more exposure as, it happens more, but it's just simply not enough. It's really sad because these women, and there's no shortage of these cases. And there I have the number somewhere. I think there's somewhat like 14 or 15 cases that were deemed suicides that are, considered like have cases that look very suspicious that were deemed suicides. But if you look into them, they're clearly not suicides.
Yeah. And nothing happened. So what ultimately with Lavina's case, nothing's done, right? I mean, there's, there's all these inquiries. I know there's been petitions. It's gone to committee, I think, on the House or Senate floor to try to have some kind of inquiry into her death, and just no one has ever paid for what they did to Lavina Johnson.
No, and I believe there are several people who should pay. I don't believe there's just, I think there may have possibly been one actual perpetrator, but I believe there's a whole host of people who know about something going on who are just not saying it.
Yeah, and one thing that I would love to see is where her tent is in compared to everybody else's, because like you said, there's a lot of people that should be implicated in this, because there was a gunshot in that tent. So, people heard the gunshot. People know, whoever came in to investigate this obviously knew that she had been murdered, probably sexually assaulted and murdered. And then literally everyone takes on the mission of covering this up and trying to make it look like a suicide. So what? So they don't look bad?
Yeah, I think probably a top military commander had something to do with this, and everyone's trying to protect that person. And if you do some digging, you'll see there's been an actual commander named, in which a lot of people on the internet seem to believe is the person responsible. I'm not going to go that far, but I will say that individual was fired from their position just about 3 weeks after Lavina's death.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. So I think, I think there's some theory is that people know what happened. And instead of bringing this commander to justice, they just, made him, I don't know if they forced him to resign or what that process is, but claiming that it was because of an extramarital affair. But who knows? Maybe, maybe people know more.
Well, and the bottom line is whether that commander, whoever was the CEO of that post, whether or not he was the actual individual that committed this crime or the one covering it up, he's equally culpable as far as I'm concerned.
100%. And so is everyone who was supposed to be, protecting her there.
Right.
Well,
it is an absolute tragic case. We're running short on our time here. So I do want to have you before I let you go. Can you touch on, just give people a couple of examples of episodes they may want to check out I'm sure all of your awesome fans will be listening to this, but you'll have some new people that have maybe never heard of Women in Crime before. Where would you recommend they go to start?
I think it depends what you're interested in, because we cover cases in which women are the victims, women are the offender, or a trailblazer in the field. And sometimes you know, it could be someone who's a victim and an offender. We know that a lot of offenders were once victims, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of victims become offenders. I'm really interested in cases of wrongful conviction. So Patricia Stallings is a fascinating case. That's a no crime wrongful conviction. Joanne mm-hmm. Parks, we did the case before she got exonerated, but since she's been exonerated, I think it's even more interesting. I like to cover cases and I like to have people listen to cases in which there's some action that could be taken. Marche Jones is another case that's very heavy on, you know, policy implications. I think that's a great one. I'm saying a lot of my cases, sorry, Megan, but these are the ones that I researched. And then there's, do you know Ellen Greenberg? Amazing. So Ellen Greenberg, you're airing this in March. So we just recently released an episode on Ellen Greenberg. And this is fascinating because this is similar to Lavina in the sense that the police were quick to say that it was a suicide. This woman was stabbed several times in the neck, and they claim that she did this to herself. And it's another one of these cases where they were so quick to just say, oh, this is a suicide. She was depressed, this and that. If you look at the evidence, there's no way this woman could have done this to herself. So those kind of cases are, to me, are really interesting. And Lavina was an early case, so we might not be as polished. So try one of our newer cases.
Right. Well, and they can try the one that you just mentioned. And coming up in 6 days, next week, Meg and Amy are going to be covering the Sandy Melgar case. So that'll be on the 23rd. So make sure you check that out. Her name is Dr. Amy Schlossberg, and the podcast is Women in Crime. Check it out. It could be your next big true crime binge. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thank you, Bob, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And you can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.